From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
We envision a world where women have equal representation in all decision-making structures of our society.
And we'll make it happen!
We envision a world where social and economic justice exists, where everyone has the food, clothing, housing, education, and medical care they need.
And we'll make it happen!
Seneca Falls, on this 150th anniversary of the first Women's Rights Convention, we'll talk about the gathering. Also, a look at Native American influence on the early feminist movement, and a statue of Sojourner Truth is unveiled. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. After 5.5 months in hiding, the man wanted in the bombing of an Alabama women's health clinic emerged from the woods of western North Carolina last week, took a large amount of food and a pickup truck from a residence, and then abandoned the truck and vanished once more. This according to federal authorities. At a news conference in Andrews, North Carolina, federal investigators said the team of agents pursuing the man, Eric Robert Rudolph, would be more than doubled from its previous size of 35. Bloodhounds have also been tracking him. The sighting last Thursday was clearly the most encouraging lead in a search that has taken investigators across hundreds of miles of mountainous terrain since January 29th, when a bomb exploded outside the New Woman All Women Healthcare Center in Birmingham, Alabama. The bombing killed an off-duty policeman who was working as a security guard at the clinic and seriously wounded a nurse. Witnesses saw a man acting suspiciously shortly after the explosion, and the North Carolina license plate on the man's truck was traced to Rudolph. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, Congress faces an abortion vote today. The House will consider a measure that would make it a crime for someone other than a parent or guardian to take a girl across state lines for an abortion. The measure has the strong support of Republican leaders in both the House and Senate, but it's opposed by most Democrats and pro-choice groups. More than 20 states require parental notification before an abortion can be performed on a girl under the age of 18. Republicans say thousands of girls are being taken across state lines for abortions without a parent's consent. Democrats contend the bill would endanger the lives of young girls who are determined to get abortions without telling their parents. There's been another Viagra-related death, this time in Japan. Japan's health ministry said today that a 60-year-old man died after taking Viagra, even though the drug is not supposed to be available in Japan. A health ministry spokesperson, however, said the ministry could not say if it was actually Viagra that caused the man's death. Viagra is produced by the U.S.-based company Pfizer, Incorporated. As of mid-June, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has reported 30 deaths associated with the drug, but most of those who died, said the agency, were elderly or had other health problems. General Motors Corporation yesterday took the unusual step of suing the United Auto Workers Union in federal court, asking for immediate arbitration to settle two paralyzing strikes that are now in their 40th day. GM contends the walkouts at two Flint, Michigan parts plants are illegal because they involve non-strikeable issues. Some 9,200 workers are on strike at the Flint Metal Center and Delphi East parts plant, where union officials have alleged health and safety violations. Union officials at Flint Metal have also accused GM of reneging on $300 million in new investments. At Delphi East, union officials say GM plans to shift work to other suppliers that would cost 2,500 union jobs. And this news from the New York Times today, breaking repeated promises it made to the American public, the Central Intelligence Agency said yesterday it will not release secret records from most of its major Cold War covert operations in the foreseeable future. The agency pledged 5 years ago to declassify thousands of files on 11 major paramilitary and political operations launched under Presidents Harry Truman, Dwight D. Eisenhower, and John F. Kennedy. It said then that records on these secret efforts at foiling communism and furthering American foreign policy in Europe, Asia, Africa, and the Caribbean would be released as early as 1994. Two former CIA chiefs, Robert Gates and R. James Woolsey Jr., personally promised that the files would be released. CIA Director George Tenet issued a statement yesterday saying the documents would not be released anytime soon. Mexican law enforcement officials have allowed the jailed former head of their national police to travel secretly to the United States to testify about alleged drug payoffs at high levels of the Mexican government. This according to today's New York Times. Former police director Adrian Carrera Fuentes told a federal grand jury in Houston in June that he collected nearly $2 million in drug bribes in 93 and 94 and turned the money over to a former colleague. This according to two officials who talked with the New York Times. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. 150 years ago, the women's rights movement grew out of the fight to abolish slavery. Angered by their exclusion from leadership and public speaking at abolitionist conventions, and inspired by Native American women, a small, dedicated group of feminists and men who were feminists, built a movement. In July 1848, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, and 300 others convened the first women's rights convention in Seneca Falls, New York. The body approved the 11 resolutions comprising the Declaration of Sentiments, including the works which would prove to be a catalyst for suffrage. Resolved that it is the duty of the women of this country to secure to themselves their sacred right to the elective franchise. The suffragists won property rights for married women, opened the doors of higher education for women, and won the vote for women in 1920. In 1923, on the 75th anniversary of the convention, Alice Paul chose Seneca Falls as the place to begin the drive for the Equal Rights Amendment, launching the campaign for women to win full justice under the law in order to end economic, education, and political equality. Right now, we're joined on the telephone by Vivian Rose. She is a historian and the staff historian for the Women's Rights National Historic Park in Seneca Falls, New York, where major events are taking place this week to commemorate the 150-year-ago convention that took place there. And we welcome you, Vivian Rose, to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Good to be with you. So can you tell us about this gathering that took place 150 years ago?
Well, the gathering, the first Women's Rights Convention in Seneca Falls, was a quick and, I wouldn't say dirty, but a quick turnaround event. It was planned about 10 days beforehand. There was only time to get two announcements in the local paper, and even so, there were about 300 people at the two-day convention. It lasted 2 days because it was planned that women would meet together the first day and discuss what they thought about the religious and social and civil condition of women, and then invite the gentlemen to join them. And because five of the five organizers, four were Quaker, this was their regular process, that the women and the men met separately when they had issues to discuss.
Vivian Rose, can you tell us who these people were who gathered at a kitchen table a few days before the Women's Rights Convention in Seneca Falls and decided to hold this meeting?
There were five people gathered around the table at Jane Hunt's house. Jane Hunt herself was the fourth wife of Richard Hunt. He was a major industrialist in Seneca County in the 1840s. By our standards, he would have been a multimillionaire. He owned property. He owned a mill. He owned businesses in town. In fact, he owned his brother-in-law's business and their home, and those were the McClintocks. Marianne McClintock was also at the table. Thomas McClintock was related to Richard Hunt because his sister, Sarah, had been Richard Hunt's third wife. So there was a family connection at the table between those two families, and the other two families who were connected were Lucretia Mott, who was a Philadelphia Quaker visiting her sister, Martha Wright, Martha Coffin Wright, who lived in Auburn. And these folks, Auburn and Waterloo, are about between 5 and 15 miles away from Seneca Falls. So the non-Quaker at the table, the one who was not related by blood, was Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And she had met Lucretia Mott in 1840 at the World Anti-Slavery Convention in London, where she was attending with her husband, who was an elected delegate from an American anti-slavery organization, as was Lucretia Mott. And the purpose of the meeting was to discuss anti-slavery efforts worldwide. However, the women who came from the United States anti-slavery organizations as delegates were not allowed to be seated, and that is where Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott met one another. Lucretia Mott wrote to a friend that she was much impressed by the young Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and they shared the same boarding room and had ample opportunity to discuss the rights of women. And Stanton said that she was admiring of Lucretia Mott's insight and wisdom and leadership, that she gained a mentor at that meeting. So those were the five who were gathered around that table. They had a number of issues to discuss. Those four Quaker women were meeting in part because Mary Ann McClintock, Jane Hunt, and Martha Coffin Wright were all in the upstate New York area, where there was a split occurring between various Quaker sects. And just the month before, Mary Ann McClintock and her husband had joined with other Quakers to lead a group out of the Hicksite Quaker meeting and create their own Friends of Human Progress, they called themselves, where they agreed that the relationship between men and women would be so equal that they would meet together. They would not have separate meetings, and that Quaker meeting houses and Quakers would be welcome to be active politically in order to be able to make changes in society, like change the fact that the United States had legal slavery at that time. So that's a little background. They did not meet in order to discuss a women's rights convention. They met to reconnect, and Lucretia Mott, as a envoy from the Philadelphia yearly meeting and as a friend of the McClintocks, who she had known in Philadelphia, was there to visit with friends and to find out how they were and what was happening in the Quaker meeting in the upstate New York area. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton was reconnecting with Lucretia Mott.
Hmm.
So the fact that of that group, they decided that they would have a convention and then move along to have a very successful one very few days later speaks volumes to their well-connectedness.
We're talking to Vivian Rose, who's the staff historian at the Women's Rights National Park in Seneca Falls, New York, where a great deal is happening over these few days. Yesterday, there was a large rally by the National Organization for Women, and later in the show, we'll hear from Patricia Ireland, the president of the National Organization for Women, who spoke, as well as Eleanor Smeal, who is the head of the Feminist Majority. We're also going to talk about the early Native American influence on the early women's rights movement in just a few minutes. But staying with Vivian Rose for a little while longer, can you tell us, I think it is surprising to many people, how closely interwoven the abolitionist movement and the early women's rights movement was. And one of the figures that embodied that was Sojourner Truth. And today you're going to be unveiling a statue of her.
That's true. The park is hosting the unveiling of a statue of Sojourner Truth that is owned by and has been created for the National Museum of Women's History. And this statue is joining a gallery of statues of Lucretia Mott, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Susan B. Anthony, which were done at the turn of the 19th century by Adelaide Johnson. Now, Adelaide Johnson is also the person who did the huge suffrage sculpture, again, of Stanton, Anthony, and Mott which is now in the rotunda of the Capitol building.
And that was a very controversial sculpture. And people may remember the controversy last year. We had a debate on it on Democracy Now, where these three women's suffrage leaders were being kept, the sculpture of them, in the crypt of the Capitol building. And women fought for them to be raised to the rotunda. But Sojourner Truth was not included in that statue. And so some groups felt that Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, and Susan B. Anthony sculpture should not be unveiled unless Sojourner Truth was included.
That's true. And the difficulty, of course, is that there are so few images of real women anywhere, that the very few that we have become carriers for all of our history. It just is not fair to all of the people who have been involved in our history, and it's not fair, in fact, to the ones who've been embodied, because they have to carry all of the meaning of the activism of the women's movement, and they didn't do all the work. So we really need many, many more sculptures of women who are active everywhere, not only in the rotunda, but everywhere. And this unveiling today is the National Museum of Women's History's effort to redress some of that wrong, to include some of those voices who have not been to date embodied in sculptures and statues.
Now, yesterday, the Democracy Now! Staff was having a debate through the day whether Sojourner Truth's speech, Ain't I a Woman, was given at the Women's Rights Convention in 1848 or not. And we learned that it was given 3 years later in Akron, Ohio, or we thought we had finally resolved the controversy until late in the day. I spoke with you, Vivian Rose, and learned something that I had never heard before, learned that Sojourner Truth's Ain't I a Woman speech ain't the speech.
That's true. It ain't the speech.
Can you explain what this speech is, Ain't I a Woman, that has been so identified with Sojourner Truth for so many years?
The Ain't I a Woman speech was published as a reminiscence by Frances Gage. Frances Gage was an activist who was the chair of the meeting in Akron, Ohio in 1851, and she recognized Sojourner Truth from the audience and allowed her to come to the podium and speak. This was protocol, as good meeting protocol, to recognize people and bring them up to the podium. And her reminiscence was that the convention was being disrupted, and it was being disrupted by hecklers who were challenging the idea that women needed rights because they had privileges. They had social privileges. They didn't need to be lifted up into carriages, or, you know, they didn't need rights because they were lifted up into carriages and they were given the best place and at the table, and people did treat them better than people with rights, so they therefore didn't need rights. And so Gage's point was that Sojourner Truth came to the podium and she squelched that heckling by her Ain't I a Woman speech. However, it was a reminiscence. It was Frances Gage's remembering of that speech. It was not that speech. And the closest version that we have to the speech was published in an anti-slavery journal, the Anti-Slavery Bugle, a newspaper, the editor of which had attended that speech. And that was published a few days to a week later. And that speech has all of the same content, but it doesn't have the Ain't I a Woman refrain in it, which is so famous to us now. All of the renderings of the Ain't I a Woman speech have Sojourner Truth saying over and over again, and ain't I a woman. Nobody gives me the best place, and ain't I a woman. And so the point there, of course, is that, yes, Sojourner Truth was a woman. Yes, of course, she didn't get the best place. And in fact, in 1851, in June, when this conference was held, she did speak, and her Ain't I a Woman speech was very important.
In fact, she wouldn't have even used the word ain't.
Well, she was a Dutch-speaking person by training. She lived with a Dutch family. When she was born, she was a slave to a Dutch family in the Hudson Valley in New York. So her first language was Dutch. She would not have spoken in a dialect, in the kind of dialect that Frances Gage was writing in. And what, of course, Frances Gage was trying to do was make it accessible, make this speech accessible and understandable. So she basically rewrote it and inserted a refrain.
We're talking to Vivian Rose. We're going to come back with her for a minute, and then we'll be joined by another historian to talk about the Native American influence on the early women's rights movement. Vivian Rose is the staff historian for the Women's Rights National Historic Park in Seneca Falls, where so many people are gathering this week for events around the 150th anniversary of the Women's Rights Convention in July of 1848. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
She makes me lie down in green meadows, beside the still waters she will lead. She restores my soul, she rights my wrongs, she leads me in a path of good things and fills my heart with songs. Even though I walk through a dark and dreary land.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest is historian Vivian Rose of the National Women's Rights Historical Park in Seneca Falls, New York. As we wrap up with her, I understand that a group, an interracial theater group called Maids in Arms, will be performing the closest version they know of Sojourner Truth's real speech on these days after you unveil the Sojourner Truth statue.
The Babes in Arms are presenting two separate plays, but one play at two different times. On Thursday, the 16th, and on Friday, the 17th, at 4 o'clock, they'll be presenting a play that is a summary of the relationship between the women's rights and the anti-slavery movements between 1833 and 1895. And in that production, the actress gives the anti-woman speech, which was reported in the Anti-Slavery Bugle on June 21st, 1851. Their organization worked very hard to make sure that they were using the most accurate information that they could. And I have to say that everything that people know about the anti-woman speech, the where did Jesus come from, God created him and a woman who bore him, where is man, where is your part, and if you have women's rights, give them to her and you will feel better because you will have your own rights and women's rights won't be so troublesome. And the ending where it says, a man is in a tight place, the poor slave is on him, woman is coming on him, he is surely between a hawk and a buzzard. These are all things that were reported immediately after. So the content of the speech, Frances Gage didn't alter, but what she did do is add that refrain. And the Babes in Arms are offering this play free of charge to those who can be in Seneca Falls. It is called Ain't I a Woman and a Sister, and it examines the ways that the African-American and the white suffragists and anti-slavery activists developed friendships that were lifelong and worked throughout their lives to end discrimination against all people.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Vivian Rose, for joining us. I know you have a lot to do today with the unveiling of the statue and the hundreds of people. Is it hundreds or thousands that are coming in?
It's thousands.
Thousands of people who are coming in for this 150th anniversary of the Women's Rights Convention. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Vivian Rose joining us from Seneca Falls, New York, as we continue this discussion of the various influences on the early women's rights movement. We're joined right now by a woman who has studied Native American influences on the women's rights movement. She joins us from community radio station WEOS in Geneva, New York, which is just a few minutes from Seneca Falls, which has been doing a wonderful job bringing out nationally the speeches and rallies that are taking place over these few days. She joins us right now in the studio in Geneva. And we welcome you to Democracy Now! We're joined by Sally Rush Wagner. Good to be with you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I should say we're also joined on the telephone by historian Margaret Washington, who is a history professor at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. For most in the country, that's just a hop, skip, and a jump away from Seneca Falls. But in fact, it's actually many hours. And we welcome you, too, Professor Washington.
Thank you.
Good to be with you both. Well, why don't we start with Sally Rush Wagner. On the issue of Native American influence, you have an exhibit in the Seneca Falls area about an issue, I think, and influences we hear very little about.
Yes, the exhibit is in the Urban Cultural Park, and it's sponsored by the Elizabeth Cady Stanton Foundation. And it's part of the telling of the untold stories that the National Park Service is doing, I think, nationwide. One of the surprises in looking at what all came to bear in bringing this woman's movement to fruition and as it developed, and the story of the influence, I think, both in giving women a vision of how the world could be created and the courage to stand up to church, state, convention, generally, and say, you tell us that our condition of subordination is a natural one, it's a divinely ordained one. We know it's not, because we've seen women who don't live like this.
Tell us about the nations that most influenced the early women's rights activists.
Well, I think it's not coincidence that all the radical reform movements, temperance, women's rights, abolition, religious, dress reform, food reform, all sprang up in Haudenosaunee or Iroquois country. In fact, when white people began to change the way that they dressed, ate, took care of their medical needs, and began to treat each other in a more egalitarian way, they were living very much as the Haudenosaunee had been living long before white people came here. I think that there may have been, assimilation may not be the appropriate word, but people seeing other people living in a very different way, and one that made in some ways more sense. Now, what has surprised me most, I think, in looking at this question, and I didn't set out to find this information, it found me. I was trying to figure out how the most radical of these women, Matilda Joslyn Gage and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, got such a strong vision of totally transforming the world. In fact, they talked about every existing institution, church, family, capitalist, and state, is based on the oppression of women, and women will not be free until every existing form of these institutions is destroyed. Well, the nations I think that most influenced were the six Iroquois nations, six nations of the Iroquois Confederacy. Lucretia Mott, for example, when she was in this region in the summer of 1848, spent a good bit of time at Cattaraugus, which is a part of the Seneca Nation, and she writes at length about what she observed. In fact, it's interesting, she writes more about her time at Cattaraugus than she writes about the first women's rights convention that she was part of creating. She writes about attending the strawberry ceremony, seeing women being part of the decision-making process, seeing women being an equal part, an integral part of the balance of this culture. Elizabeth Cady Stanton was... her closest neighbor in Seneca Falls was an adopted Onondagan, a man named Orrin Tyler, and she talks about him in her autobiography. He had lived at Onondaga, been a trader there, learned the language, spoke it fluently, had been adopted into one of the clans. And when he lived in Seneca Falls, the reports say that when his Onondaga relatives came to visit, they always stayed with their brother, Orrin Tyler. Matilda Jocelyn Gage, and the third woman who I think was most deeply influenced by the Iroquois, was in fact adopted into the Wolf Clan of the Mohawk Nation. She was given a name which is still in use among the Mohawks today. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton, to get back to another one of the nations, Elizabeth Cady Stanton's cousin, Gerrit Smith, who was, I think, in many ways her intellectual mentor, certainly her radical reform mentor, she met her husband, Henry, at her cousin Gerrit's house. Gerrit's brother was named Peter Skenandoah, and he was named for the Oneida chief. The Oneidas were very close friends of the Smith family, had been for several generations. And Henry Stanton talks about going to visit Cousin Gerrit, and there were always fugitive slaves and Indians and radical reformers of every ilk. So I think all of these women didn't have indirect contact. They all had direct contact with Haudenosaunee women. And so when they lived in a world where women had no say in government, for example, they knew and wrote about, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Matilda Jocelyn Gage both wrote about the women choosing the chiefs, the women, in the words of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, being the ones who cut off the horns of the chiefs if they didn't carry out their responsibilities. The women had that responsibility to nominate and to remove. The clan mothers did. Matilda Jocelyn Gage, in fact, was arrested for voting in her own village the same year that she was adopted into the Mohawk Nation and given a say in her clan in the choosing of the chief. In other words, she had a vote, if we might use that term incorrectly, I think, but she had a say in the choosing of the representative of her clan in her adopted nation the same year that she was arrested for voting in her own nation.
And you're listening to Sally Resch Wagner, who's a pioneer of women's studies, first woman to receive a doctorate in women's studies and founder of one of the first college women's studies programs. She has a Native Women's History Project going on right now at Seneca Falls as thousands of people come in to celebrate the 150th anniversary of the Women's Rights Convention. Why do you think so little has been written about the Native influence, Sally Resch Wagner?
Well, I can only speak for myself. I've considered myself somewhat informed in this area, and it was many, many years into my studies before I came into this information. It was always there. I just didn't have eyes to see it. In fact, Matilda Jocelyn Gage, in her major work, Woman, Church, and State, which is perhaps the most important theoretical work written in the 19th century women's movement, she says, never was justice more perfect, never was civilization higher. She's describing the Haudenosaunee. Now, that should have been a clear giveaway, a dead giveaway, that there was something very important going on here. But I have to confess that I had many of the, I think, stereotypic notions of Native women. I thought, well, they're just beasts of burden. What could they have taught the women's rights movement anyway? And so I think this information has carried me kicking and screaming into an acceptance of it. And it's amazing to me because each time I think, well, there can't be another influence. In fact, there is. In working on this exhibit, for example, I had thought, because it was, I think it was the director of the Onondaga Historical Association who first showed me a picture of an Oneida woman's costume and a picture of the dress reform costume, which came to be known as the bloomer, and said, you tell me there's no relationship between these two. So in the back of my mind was, well, maybe there was some influence on dress reform as well. As we began to study further in preparing for this exhibit, what we realized was that the first woman to wear the bloomer was not, as we've been telling the story for many years, Elizabeth Smith Miller, who was Elizabeth Cady Stanton's cousin in 1851. It was 3 years earlier, in 1848, In fact, we're celebrating the 150th anniversary of the women's reform costume this year, women wearing pants, I guess. In 1848, women in the Oneida community, which was a utopian community, which actually was on land that had been previously owned by the Oneida or been the land of the Oneida Nation, these women developed a reform costume. The head of the Oneida community, John Humphrey Noy, said, "We really need to eliminate distinctions in dress between men and women because they both further and reflect the unequal status of women." So women, inspired by this in the community, sat down, they said, in an Indian log house. It was, in fact, one that had been a Oneida Nation's house. And they set to work developing another costume, not the 18-inch corseted waist with 20 pounds of clothing suspended from them that was fashion's dictate at the time. No, they developed a loose-fitting sort of tunic, slightly gathered at the waist, and leggings. Not trousers, but leggings. Who wears leggings? I don't know anybody who does except for Native women. And the leggings that they wore, they then fastened to their dresses either through buttons or through sewing them. And I think that this sort of connection is quite remarkable.
Sally Rush Wagner, we're going to have you back on again in the next few days. I believe on Monday we are going to have you in dialogue, you in character as Elizabeth Cady Stanton, speaking with Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass, the well-known abolitionist who ran the North Star newspaper, who was at the Women's Rights Convention of 1848, worked with Elizabeth Cady Stanton until their split. But we're not going to talk about that right now because we're going to have a full hour on that on Monday on Democracy Now! But if people want to get a hold of the Native American influence exhibit that you have put together, since events are taking place all through this year on the spirit of Seneca Falls around the country, from California to Nebraska, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, Iowa, all over, where can they call?
It's actually a traveling exhibit, and so they could get in touch with the Women's Rights National Historical Park in Seneca Falls, and they will then in turn get in touch with me, and we'll see that it travels. I also wrote curriculum on how to tell the untold stories using the untold story of the Iroquois influence on the early women's rights movement as an example. I wrote the curriculum for the park, and that's also available through the Women's Rights National Historical Park.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us from Seneca, New York. And the phone number of the Women's Rights National Historical Park is 315-568-0077. That's 315-568-0077. And Sally Rush Wagner, thanks for being with us. We're going to have you on again in a few days. So thanks so much for this aspect of your input on this celebratory week. We are joined on the telephone, as I said, right now by Cornell University women's historian Margaret Washington. And she is a historian who has been working on this issue of Sojourner Truth and what exactly she said, and also the role of African-American women 150 years ago. And we welcome you, Professor Washington, to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
We just heard a brief synopsis of the controversy over the speech that Sojourner Truth gave, actually not 150 years ago, but 147 years ago in Akron, Ohio. But maybe you can flesh that out for us. Just what role Sojourner Truth played in the movement with her statue being unveiled today at the National Women's Historical Park in Seneca Falls?
Well, Sojourner Truth was very important to the women's rights movement after 1850. She had no role whatsoever in the Seneca Falls Convention of 1848. She was not in New York at that time. She was in Northampton, Massachusetts. But at the Akron, Ohio Convention, where this controversial so-called Ain't I Woman speech was delivered, that was sort of the beginning of her impact on women's rights, particularly as those rights affected African-American women. And she was very active in that sense. And as she used to say, "I guess I'm the only colored woman who goes around talking about the rights of colored women."
And that was certainly true, because with the exception of the Grimke sisters, and including black men, no one talked about the rights of black women, except Sojourner.
We were just speaking with historian Vivian Rose, who's the staff historian at the National Women's Historical Park in Seneca Falls, who said, actually, told me yesterday it was based on your work and the work of historian Nell Painter that she learned that the speech was not the same as the famous speech, "Ain't I a Woman," that people have come to identify Sojourner Truth with. We have to break for stations to identify themselves, but when we come back, I'd like to ask you about that. And then we're going to hear a speech given at a rally yesterday in Seneca Falls by now President Patricia Ireland. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with Professor Washington in a minute.
Hit 'em a little, hit 'em, 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 hit 'em,
this is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! On the 150th anniversary of the Women's Rights Convention in Seneca Falls, New York, where thousands are gathering for events this week to commemorate the Women's Rights Convention. We're joined on the phone now by Cornell University historian Margaret Washington, who has looked at the early women's rights movement and particularly the role of African American women. We were just talking about Sojourner Truth and the actual speech that she gave. How did you reconstruct that?
Well, I reconstructed it by simply going back to Ohio and knowing that Sojourner Truth was in Ohio at that time and going through the anti-slavery newspapers. The anti-slavery bugle was edited out of Ohio, out of Salem, Ohio, which is the area that Sojourner Truth was lecturing out of. So I went back and looked at the newspapers for accounts of that speech, and there was the account written, we think, by Marius Robinson, who at that time was the editor of the Bugle and a very good friend of Sojourner's. And he gave his version, and of course it was an on-the-spot version of the speech, whereas the one that has come down to us was given in retrospect by Francis Gage in 1863.
Years later, more than
right.
a decade later.
Yes.
What about the role of African American women in the Seneca Falls Convention, or the lack of role?
Well, Seneca Falls was a very significant beginning, as you know. And the women's rights movement in this country began as a middle-class movement of white women. These women, Lucretia Mott, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, they were well-educated, well-bred, well-off women. They were, of course, reformers, and they were deeply interested in the anti-slavery movement. As a matter of fact, it's important to point out that their concern about issues in relation to women grew out of the fact that they were excluded from the World Anti-Slavery Convention in England, even though they had been sent as delegates by their regions in the United States. And so even though they were the mainspring of the anti-slavery movement in the United States, at this international meeting, even though they were the designated representatives, they could not take their seats because they were women. And so their attitude was, you know, what are we fighting for and who are we fighting for if we don't have these basic rights ourselves? But I think, and of course that was very noble, I think the problem was that in their zeal to point out the wrongs of women, they did not include black women in this.
And specifically, in what sense? In a few days, we're going to have this dialogue between two actor historians, between Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Frederick Douglass, specifically around this issue. But they did ultimately split over the issue of the vote for black men and not including white women.
Well, even Douglass, you know, as progressive as he was, his concern was in regard to this debate after the Civil War, was for the rights of black men, which actually the debate ought to be three ways, because it was Stanton, Douglass, and Truth, because Sojourner Truth sort of felt in the middle, because she didn't want black women to be left out either, on the one hand. On the other hand, she understood the urgency of the need for black men to have the franchise. So black women have sort of been left out in regard to black men getting the franchise, as well as black white women getting their rights, not just the electoral right, but other rights, property rights, and so on. They just have been sort of caught in the middle of this this debate. And I think that's what's going to happen tomorrow if you don't have someone representing the voice of black women, because Frederick Douglass does not.
Well, I hope actually tomorrow that we will have members of the theatrical group Babes in Arms, who are performing up at Seneca Falls, an interracial group that will bring us the what they understand is the best version up to this date of Sojourner Truth's speech, again, not in 1848, but in 1851, and how black feminists of the time related to white feminists. Any final words, Professor Washington, on
well,
this day?
You know, I would like to say something about this speech. There's been, at least among scholars, it's a very small community, a lot of discussion of women historians about the authenticity of the speech as it has come down to us, the anti-woman speech. And, of course, in my forthcoming biography, I take a position on it as well. But, and I feel that what Frances Gage, the person who took down the account that we know, was doing was essentially publicizing Sojourner Truth and showing the nation what a very significant, what a very important woman she was. At the same time, I think that she misrepresented Sojourner Truth in the way she depicted her, especially with the dialogue, because, of course, Sojourner Truth was a Dutch woman, not a Southern woman, and so she wouldn't speak in dialect. However, there seems to be, if you look at both copies of the speech, both as it was taken down at the time and what Frances Gage handed down to us, in my opinion, with the exception of the dialect and the use of the word nigger, which Sojourner Truth never used, the essence of the both speeches are pretty much the same. And they boil down to women's rights. In the original version, Sojourner Truth says, "I am women's rights." In Frances Gage's version, she says, "Ain't I a woman?" And both of those mottos come from the anti-slavery motto that was emblazoned on badges and emblems and banners, which said simply, "Am I not a woman and a sister?" And so I think both versions of the speech capture that. And I think that it's important to get beyond whether or not one is authentic or more authentic than the other and look upon them both as representing the progression of women in American society.
Well, Professor Margaret Washington, I want to thank you very much for joining us from Ithaca, New York, from Cornell University, to give us this analysis of Sojourner Truth on this day when her statue will be unveiled at the National Women's Historical Park in Seneca Falls, New York. And I very much look forward to your biography of Sojourner Truth.
Thank you.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move to a speech given yesterday in Seneca Falls. Yesterday, the National Organization for Women held a rally commemorating the sesquicentennial of Seneca Falls, a new word maybe for many of you. It certainly was for me, the 150th anniversary. They billed this as only partly a celebration and partly a protest because New York Republican Governor George Pataki has come under fire by Now and other feminist organizations for leaving the state's Lieutenant Governor and only woman delegate Betsy McCoy Ross out of the opening events of the Seneca Falls commemoration billed as Celebrate 98, leaving, at least according to Now, no women in the New York delegation on this anniversary. At the rally, Now President Patricia Ireland and Feminist Majority Leader Eleanor Smeal spoke about this egregious space that is now left in the New York delegation, and that is a space for women. We bring you Patricia Ireland's speech.
Is feminism dead?
No!
Are you sure?
Yes!
I thought so. What a wonderful celebration we've been having. And I wanted to share with those who weren't at the conference and remind those of us who were of some of the sections from the wonderful Declaration of Sentiments for the 21st Century that NOW members created at our weekend conference. You'll also note that I am putting in a couple of extra sentences for something that just came to our attention this last couple of days. I want to start first with our actual vision statement, and I want to ask you to add your voices.
And we will make it happen.
All right, and the line that you will say after each line of the vision, where I say, we envision a world, and then continue, you will say, and we'll make it happen. And we'll make it happen, okay? Now, how many of you were cheerleaders in high school or college? I'm serious. Hold up your hands. Okay, all right. This is where those talents you learned that you never thought would be of good use in the feminist movement, I want you out there leading, and we'll make it happen, okay? Can you do a little dance to that? All right. Okay, and baton twirlers. How many baton twirlers? All right. This was adopted on the 12th of July. On this 12th of July, 1998, the delegates of the National Organization for Women gathered in convention in the 150th year of the women's rights movement. We bring passion, anger, hope, love, and perseverance to create this vision for the future. We envision a world where women's equality and women's empowerment to determine our own destinies is a reality, and we'll make it happen. We envision a world where women have equal representation in all decision-making structures of our society.
And we'll make it happen.
We envision a world where social and economic justice exists, where everyone has the food, clothing, housing, education, and medical care they need.
And we'll make it happen.
We envision a world where there is recognition and respect for each person's intrinsic worth, as well as the rich diversity of the various groups among us.
And we'll make it happen.
We envision a world where nonviolence is the established order.
And we'll make it happen.
We envision a world where patriarchal culture and male dominance no longer oppress us or our earth. We envision a world where women and girls are heard, valued, and respected.
And we'll make it happen.
Yes, we will. In the past 32 years, women have advanced farther than in any previous generation, yet we still do not have full equality. How ironic that at the opening ceremony for Celebrate 98, celebrating the 150th anniversary of the first women's rights convention in the world, the New York delegation at the opening ceremony will be all men. And so our celebration is also a protest. We've found our voices, we've won our votes, but apparently Pataki and others still don't want to see women in power. Actually, of course, that's good news, because what that means is the Pataki campaign is truly frightened of having this woman, who is the only statewide elected official who is female, only the second woman ever to hold the job of lieutenant governor in all the years that New York State has existed, and he cannot rise above petty partisan politics to have her on the stage. Or, I was told this morning by a reporter, he denies having any influence in that. We weren't born Democrat, we weren't born Republican, and we weren't born yesterday. But if Governor, soon-to-be Mr. Pataki, is truly not afraid of the Lieutenant Governor, Betsy McCoy Ross, let him join with our call to have her join him on the stage at the opening ceremonies. You might have noticed that's the addition to our vision statement. And we'll make it happen. We have moved more feminists than ever before into all of the institutions that shape our society. We've achieved some measure of power to affect change in these institutions from within. Yet still, we are far from full equality in decision making. We demand an equal share of power in our families, in religion, in law, medicine, the arts, humanities, sports, education, the trades and professions, labor and management, the media, corporations and small businesses, as well as government. In no sphere of life will women be silenced, underrepresented, or undervalued. Today, we reaffirm our demand for constitutional equality for women and girls. And we'll make it happen.
And you're listening to the speech of Now President, that's the National Organization for Women President, Patricia Ireland, yesterday in Seneca Falls, New York, part of the events that are taking place throughout the week. Tomorrow, Hillary Clinton will be speaking. In fact, an earlier guest of ours today, Sally Rush Wagner, rushed off to meet with Hillary Clinton and talk about the Native American influence on the early women's rights movement with Hillary Clinton. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And one of the people who were included in the rally yesterday was Sandy Rapp, and she was dedicating the rally to the late Congresswoman Bella Abzug.
Looks in time across the planets to where you can find a reincarnate U.S. of A. Which enjoys a certain shift of focus, you might say. Choice is a given, and it's so fact. Chief Justice Barbara Jordan's got a handle on that. And when the band plays Hail to the Chief, President Abzug appears on the screen. And they sing hats off to Bella, kudos to her. Top of the morning, top of the world, the stars and stripes, the red, white, and blue. President Abzug, here's to you.
Again, the number to call if you'd like today's program is 1-800-735-0230 to order a cassette copy. That's 1-800-735-0230. And Sandy Rapp's song, Hats Off to Bella, is included in a whole medley of songs on her CD, We the People. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hee Soo Koo and Jeremy Scahill. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Special thanks to Mike Black and our other colleagues at WEOS in Geneva, New York. Julie Drizin's our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman from the studios of WBAI in New York for Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
And they sing hats off to Bella. She's got it all. Right on the money. Right on the phone. The stars and stripes, the red, white,